Songwriters have perhaps the most creative job in the music business. Victoria Banks literally gets paid to come up with new tunes and lyrics on a regular basis. So she has to be prepared.
For me, I carry around a list of ideas, hooks, we call them, you know, for songwriters, and they're often titles. And I had the phrase Saints and Angels pop into my head, and I wrote it down because I thought it was an interesting phrase, but I had no idea what it meant. And I carried it around for years. And then all of a sudden, one day, I was looking through my book of hooks. And at the time in my life, I was falling in love. And all of a sudden, I saw that in a new context. And I was like, I know what that is. I know what that means now.
Just two tarnished hearts, but in each other's arms, we become saints and angels.
And so I ended up writing it from the perspective of, you know, love takes a faulty human being and lifts them up into something like saints and angels.
Broken wing, I love you when you hold me.
How long did it take you to write that?
An hour. It took an hour. That was one of those lightning striking you in the head songs.
Country singer Sarah Evans recorded Saints and Angels in 2000. It got radio play and was one of Victoria's biggest hits. Today, I'm having a conversation with three people who seem to get struck in the head by lightning, creatively speaking, more often than most. They start with a blank page and end with something that didn't exist before. Victoria Banks is your quintessential Nashville Music City creative, a country songwriter. Bryce McLeod runs a letterpress printing shop in Nashville and creates public art and a really random smattering of other artistic things that are hard to summarize in one sentence.
My best ideas, I feel like they weren't mine, like they sprung from themselves and forced their way into my life.
And TJ Jarrett. She's a poet with two published collections of work focusing on family and history and race.
Bringing that out, kind of unleashing those feelings is a beautiful thing, and it's kind of, I find it healing.
From Nashville Public Radio, this is Movers and Thinkers, where I get to put three of the most interesting people in the city in one room and pepper them with questions. I'm your host, Emily Seiner, and I talk to these three creators inside WPLN Studio C in front of a live audience.
This episode of Movers and Thinkers is sponsored by Pick Tennessee Products. They believe farm-grown meat and produce can inspire creative home cooks and award-winning chefs alike. Check out their new mobile app to find restaurants that shop and cook local. PickTNProducts.org. And by the Jennings A. Jones College of Business at Middle Tennessee State University. It graduates creative entrepreneurs who change their communities for the better. Working professionals can get an MBA in 12 months, in person or online, with specialties in music business and healthcare management. Visit mtsu.edu/MBA.
Okay, so where were we? Oh, yeah, getting struck by lightning. I asked TJ about this.
The idea of creativity is often this, it's romanticized as this burst of inspiration. And I know that's not realistic. There's a lot of hard work that goes into creating things. But do those sorts of products feel more satisfying? Like, are you happiest with the ones that come easily?
There are ones that come easily, but this is the caveat. It's a numbers game. So you have to keep just throwing up the layups and sucking a lot. Like, how many ways can you fail until you actually succeed? And you have to just have this kind of a fearlessness that has to happen before something actually sticks. When people talk about, you know, that lightning bolt has come because you wrote like six or seven really bad songs that you started with that,
exactly.
But it didn't work out.
Well, and you're learning too, as you go, you're learning your structure, you're learning your craft.
This is Victoria again.
I've listened to a million songs on the radio and written a zillion songs, and you get those bursts inside that context of what you've built and worked on and worked on.
But learning your craft is only part of creating things. Creativity itself, she believes, that's something innate.
I think you're absolutely born with it, but everyone is born with it. I mean, you can visit a kindergarten class and ask them to draw a picture of the house they live in, and everybody's going to do it, and probably pretty enthusiastically. But if you go back and visit those same kids a few years later and you ask them to do the same thing, probably half of them are going to be like, oh, I can't draw. somewhere along the way, people learn that they're not creative, but I think everyone can. Everyone does it.
I can't imagine a world in which we're not. I mean, I think creativity is kind of an extension of abstract thinking.
Next to TJ, Bryce, the letterpress printer and public artist, has been nodding for a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, I totally agree. I think everybody's born creative, and that creativity takes many shapes. I mean, everything that we do is problem solving in some fashion.
So how do you translate that creativity into art? This is something that Victoria thinks about a lot. She occasionally runs corporate team building events where she helps a group of people write a song together.
And a lot of the time it looks like they want to just run out the door as fast as they can. But an hour later, once you've walked them through the process of brainstorming and daring to suck, which is my slogan for creativity, then they have a song and they're so excited about it.
When you were saying that, I was lucky enough to do this project with Nashville. We went around and asked people to make self-portraits of themselves.
Bryce started this self-portrait project for people in a homeless shelter in Nashville, and then he expanded it out. He would just set up at a place like the public library or a farmer's market and give people a piece of blank paper and some tools.
One of the reasons we did it was I wanted to push people to be creative, and one of the things that I took away from it is that everybody wants to be productive and to be creative. And I think that there is that fear of failure, but I think most people, if they just have a moment, can get through it, and then they have a wonderful experience.
After interviewing Bryce, I would say his biggest joy doesn't seem to come from just creating nice-looking things. It comes from solving problems in a really whimsical way.
I was talking with some people about an art show that was coming up, and there was a difficulty in that it was going to be in a gas station in a non-traditional space, and there weren't any walls. And we were just sort of like sitting there and brainstorming and talking, and it came out this like, well, what if we just put the art on helium balloons and we won't have to worry about walls. I don't remember if I said that or if someone else said it, but as soon as it was said, there was like this lightning struck. I was like, oh. I instantly saw that it was like so much more democratic, and I had this vision of a little kid seeing a piece of art float down from the sky into their backyard, and I was like, I have to do that. And then the process worked from that, solving those problems.
That art installation, or maybe de-installation, was in 2006. And since then, he started solving problems artistically for some high-profile businesses in Nashville, like the artisanal, ultra-hip coffee shop Barista Parlor. Just recently, they asked him to design something cool they could sell their beans in.
Like, our thing is putting art and coffee together. And we spend a lot of time making the spaces look beautiful. And we wanted to give that same experience to people who took it home. Imagine a world beyond craft paper bags that whole bean coffee could come in. So this thing is it's a box. It's letterpressed at my shop. Each one is handmade. It's from hand drawings. And inside of that are coffee beans, and it's sealed at the top with a cap, and you can crack it open and then pour the coffee out.
Bryce, where do you get your inspiration? How does it come to you?
Well, what I deem my best ideas, I feel like they weren't mine. Like they sprung from themselves and forced their way into my life. And I'm just like, well, here, this thing. And, you know, and I think that for me, that's exciting because it's like a hunt, you know. It's, in a way, what my job is to tune in and to be quiet sometimes and hear the radio station that we all could hear if we're listening for it.
I love that you talked about tuning into like a universal radio station.
Yeah.
I just have to like relate to that with you for a moment, because when I signed my first publishing deal and I was expected to write every day and turn in all these songs, I would go through this angst every time I had to get up in the morning and write a song. It was like, oh, I don't know how to do it. I wrote one yesterday, but how will I write one today? And it was just so overwhelming, that fear of the blank page. It took me several years. And then I realized, wait a minute, it's not that I have to create this thing. I mean, I know they call it creativity, but it's not that I have to create it. It's that I just need to be the faucet and let the water come through. And all of a sudden I can just trust that something's there.
Yeah. I find it's really interesting because when I'm writing, I have to have cacophony. Like, I love silence. Silence is beautiful. But the magic doesn't happen in the silence. I have to like be in a bar or at my best friend's house where her two children are loud and yelling at each other. And I have to have that noise. And as if somehow it winnows down. And so like maybe in complete silence, all the stations are coming through and I just need to dial to the one I need to listen to. So I have to have all the noise around me.
Yeah.
Conversely, to do that. Yeah.
I'm really into this metaphor. Love radio stations. TJ, I want to talk about how your poetry often pulls from historical material.
Yes.
And that's sort of where it starts.
I would say, yes, a lot of them are history, but I think the main project is memory. How we remember the same event is always interesting when you're talking to like your brother. It's like, that's not how it happens. It's like, that's exactly. No. I have one about my dad fixing cars that I wrote recently. And I love it because it's this, he used to fix cars every Saturday with the radio on. And so it was very interesting thinking about my father and how to make that a universal experience that anyone who had a father in a crappy car could relate to. So this is called Of Late I've Been Thinking About Despair. And it's ruthless syntax and the ease with which it interjects itself into our days. I thought how best to explain this dark winter, but that wasn't it. Or beds unshared, but that wasn't exactly it either, until I remembered Saturday afternoon spent with my father in the garage and those broken cars one after another. At the time, that's what we could afford, broken things. Saturdays, there was always a game on the radio, and I'd stand beside him or lie under the engine, the oil cascading from the oil pan. Daddy would curse wildly, sometimes about the car and sometimes about the game. Sometimes, Mama would call for one or the other of us from upstairs, and I'd trudge up to see what she wanted with a sigh. We sighed a lot then. Funny. If you asked us if you were happy, I'd say, families, they're happy. There's a solace in broke-down cars. You can find what is broken, and you can make it whole again. I'd pop the hood, I'd peer into the sooty inside, and Daddy would pass me some parts for my small hands to tender to each need. Daddy'd scramble into the front seat, he'd turn a key, and a roar would come out that would be a cause for rejoicing. But time came, and this is the inevitable part, where he would draw the white handkerchief to his head and surrender. I'd always ask if we could have just tried a little harder. Baby girl, he'd say, she's gone. So, yeah, we had so many bad cars. Like, he just, God. And my brother and I are both kind of like, oh, did it, like, make this creaky noise? It's going out back and getting shot. Like, that's our reaction.
So what is the emotion that you feel when you wrote that or when you read it?
When I wrote that, I was really thinking about how we remembered that time. And it's the memory itself may be quite clinical. It's like, hey, I remember those times we had these crappy cars. How do I put that 74 Dodge Polara into a poem? And I somehow wanted to have that image, have that really horrible car be anybody's really horrible car that could be fungible. Like someone else could put their crappy car, their, you know, 74 Dodge Dart, for example, into that one. So what happens when you have a memory like that, it freights itself with other things. And so it's kind of a melancholy poem, really, about, you know, back when we were poor, and that's what we had, and that's the best we could do. One of the most important things I learned as I was learning to write was that image has meaning for me, but it also has meaning for my reader, and I don't need to get in the way of what my reader is going to bring to that image. You stop owning it. The moment it goes out in the world, it's not yours anymore. And that's the hardest lesson of all.
And then sometimes it'll happen, like for Saints and Angels, the song we were talking about. So I wrote that song from the perspective of someone falling in love. And it was released as a single to radio about a week or 2 weeks before 9/11 happened. And at that point, all of a sudden, things weren't apropos anymore and things were sounding different than they were intended to sound. And the song Saints and Angels ended up being made into like a 9/11 song where they took the second verse out and they put quotes from the, you know, the first responders and things like that. And so all of a sudden this love song became about a much bigger love than the kind of love that I was talking about. So it was really, you know, it was fascinating to see this.
Yeah, I might have my reasons for doing the things that I do, but what I'm really fascinated by is as soon as you do turn it over to other people and they start saying things to you, and for me, I start to realize that, oh yeah, I kind of did mean that, or like there's these multiple meanings, and I think that that's what's beautiful about the creative arts. It's about a car, but it's not about a car.
Coming up, Victoria plays the song that helped her process a traumatic event in her life. TJ talks about what it takes to feel like a writer, and Bryce explains why he's trying to create his own personal currency. Stay with us.
This episode of Movers and Thinkers is sponsored by Pick Tennessee Products, which wants more people to buy local meat and produce. Like James Beard Award-winning chef Tandy Wilson does at the Nashville Farmers Market.
We're here for zucchini and yellow squash. You know, we want to know exactly how it tastes as it's coming off the farm. So come this way.
He chats with farmers and digs through produce bins. On one summer Saturday, he fills up a basket with emerald green zucchini that he'll use in his restaurant, City House.
I'm going to make a raw salad, and it gets like an anchovy dressing with red onions and pecorino and breadcrumbs. So it's buy good stuff and do a little bit to it.
Find local restaurants serving food right off the farm at picktnproducts.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Jennings A. Jones College of Business at Middle Tennessee State University. To learn about what makes a great business school, I went to a surprising place, a brunch at Stephanie Pruitt's house.
Make yourself at home. There are egg casseroles, pancakes are in the works, water, coffee right there, mimosas on the back.
Pruitt's brunches are a place where artists can network with business people. Pruitt is both, because in her Jones College marketing classes, she learned that it's possible to make art and still make a living.
And that has made all the difference in me being a working artist and a poet who will also be able to send her own daughter to college because of my poetry.
You can get a business degree, online or in person, in as little as 12 months with the Flex MBA program from Jones College of Business. Go to mtsu.edu/MBA.
This is Movers and Thinkers from Nashville Public Radio. I'm Emily Siner. I'm talking to songwriter Victoria Banks, poet TJ Jarrett, and public artist Bryce McLeod about creativity. One of the beautiful things about talking to these people is that their art is clearly an expression of who they are. It can be very personal. Here's Victoria.
There's a song that I wrote called Firefly. And at the time, I was just coming back into songwriting again after experiencing my mom's death. And my mom actually took her own life. She was dealing with mental illness. And it was just this huge trauma in my life that just kind of stopped everything. You know, it was scary, the thought of getting back into the songwriting chair again, because I didn't know what the heck I was going to say about where I was and what I was feeling. And so this song was really, it came from a metaphor from my childhood where my dad really made the world completely magical. And so the place where we lived up in Canada, we lived on a dirt road, and we'd walk out this dirt road at dusk, and it would open up into a farmer's field that was completely full of fireflies. But at the time, he had us convinced that those were fairies. It was like, it just hit me. I was just so happy to finally have found a way to express the sadness I was feeling, but with light in it at the same time, which was what this song ended up being. So, get my guitar here.
Firefly, how do you keep your light on here in a dark world? I want to be a light like you. In that black sky, you're not afraid of midnight. You've got a way of shining bright. How your sparks ignite. Maybe that's what life is all about. Finding faith in the shadow of your doubt. You gotta shine, you gotta shine your light. Just like a firefly.
So did that help you process your mom's death in a different way?
Yeah, I absolutely think it did. I mean, I think I wrote a lot of songs after that. I had kind of found a way to break through and say it, I guess. And I do a therapeutic songwriting program. There's a organization called Operation Song in Nashville that works with veterans, and you go and sit with a veteran and you hear their story and then you write it with them in the room. And there's something to being able to take your emotion or your experience and put it into a song that is like, so often people will say, I feel like this weight is lifted off me because I don't have to carry it around anymore because I've put it somewhere safe. And that's kind of how I feel about that.
This catharsis is something TJ has experienced as well. In her latest collection of poems called Zion, she writes about a terrible event in 1964, the murder of three civil rights workers in Mississippi who were trying to help Black Southerners register to vote. And her poems are written from the perspective of different people, like her mom, who was 13 at the time.
It's about her growing up through this really fraught time and how I would imagine my mother to have passed through. But after reading from it and reading poem after poem of, you know, this is my grandmother's reaction, this is Miss Polly from across the street's reaction, and having women who've lived through the same thing come out and just hug you. It's like, I needed someone to tell me this. I needed to hear the story of this. This is the history that no one ever tells you about. Because you can read the story, you know, in the newspaper. That's what the newspaper is for. It's about facts. You know, there's not a dearth of facts when I'm writing about my mother's life or writing about them finding the bodies. But I do bring in like how we felt about that, how vulnerable we must feel about that. My grandmother had this OCD thing where she'd count her children. She had four. There's only, you know, count to four, but she would count them every single night, three and four and five times a night, because she didn't know. She wasn't sure what happens if they slip out. She knows the world is a terribly dangerous place where people slip out are never heard from again. And sometimes you find them in the swamp, but that's only because the FBI is out there. No one's looking for a Black girl of age 13. No one's looking for her. So that, bringing that out, kind of unleashing those feelings is a beautiful thing. And it's kind of, I find it healing.
Yeah. Bryce, I don't get the sense that your work is quite as emotion driven, but how much of it is an expression of yourself and how much of it is creating something for other people?
These projects that we do out in the world and the things that I think about, to me are highly emotional. I want to create a place where people have particular emotions. I just think that there's an idea of like the revelatory experience. So when you come around the corner and you experience a piece of art or something you didn't expect and give people a chance to have a new perspective on the world is really a big part of what I want to do.
On that note, I wonder, like, a lot of your art is in sort of public commercial spaces like coffee shops and a bowling alley and a baseball stadium. Mm-hmm. Does the fact that it's so commercial in some ways make it more or less valuable to you?
Well, my goal is to impact the greatest amount of people that I can. And I think that we're using commercial channels, but I always think I'm serving a higher artistic purpose. So for me, I believe strongly in having the high temples of art, the galleries and, you know, the opera houses and things like that. There's just a huge audience that doesn't feel welcome there or feels like that's not their place. And what I want to do is to give them that quality of experience, but put it in a place that they feel comfortable. So to me, that putting things where the people are is for me super important.
TJ, for you, now that you're selling your work, does that make it more meaningful or less meaningful?
You know, the selling the work, I mean, as a poet, you pretty much, my parents are so proud. As a commercial enterprise, I pretty much gave up on that a long time ago.
I just created my own money to solve this problem.
Bryce is rifling through this box of stuff he brought and pulls out this oversized cartoonish dollar bill with his face in the middle.
I think a lot about how our culture values No, everything, not just creativity, but people's time and why one person's time is more valuable than another's. And even just how we decided that these pieces of paper are something that we would sometimes be willing to kill one another over. It's sort of a beautiful delusion that we've all agreed to, that I'll do that for you. And then I'm going to hand this to you because we're all in agreement that we've given worth to this thing, and it doesn't matter what it is. So I wanted to create an ecosystem that was based on a different set of values. We do things for money because we all have to eat, but the reason that I get up and do what I do is for the love of it and for the goal of making the world a little bit better than I found it. And all of the people that I interact on a daily basis with have that same feeling. So in some ways, like, the joke was just that we could start using these in place of the money that we weren't making and could trade to other people.
Have you gotten anyone to agree to use the Brace Bucks?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a nascent thing, to be sure, still.
It's an emerging economy. That's what
that's
saying.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
All right.
It's a get in on the ground floor, kids.
How is your work valued? That's a big question for any creative person. But what TJ found is sometimes when someone else outside of your own head values your work, it doesn't really make that much of a difference.
I always had this idea of, like, you know, when my first poem's in Poetry Magazine, I'm going to be a writer. I've been postponing calling myself a writer all my life. When my first, you know, when I have my first book, I'm going to feel like a writer. There is never a time that you will feel like you've accomplished all the things. Maybe it's because I'm a girl and I just have that girl thing. But, like, you never, the outside validation doesn't matter. That's what I've discovered as I've kind of passed through, like, accolades and whatever. It stops mattering, and it's really just you in a dark room with a pen and a piece of paper. And that's, like, when the real stuff's happening.
I guess for me, the validation comes from having had these dreams and these visions of things that I never in my life thought would ever be possible. And to see that a room full of people is enjoying an idea that I had in my head, and that we're coming together in this beautiful way so that we could have that moment together. And
yeah,
I think that's beautiful.
Yeah. Connection is a beautiful thing.
That's kind of awesome.
That makes me think of, so somebody sent me a picture on Facebook. It was just, you know, a fan. It was no one that I knew. They sent me a picture of a relative of theirs had a gravestone with a line from one of my songs carved into it. I mean, I was like,
for real.
You know, it's not about the song playing on the radio. It's like, okay, they connected with what I was trying to say to that level.
That's the power of public art. That's what these three people are so passionate about. But someone in the audience had this question.
Is there anything that you have that you just create for yourself and it won't see the light of day?
I paint pottery on Fridays. We get a box of Chardonnay and we hang out. No one's going to see that. No.
Like 90% of the songs that I write will never get heard by anybody. So I guess that counts.
I didn't think any of this would see the light of day. So, you know, it's like lately the balance for me at least has swung. It's all directed to public. But I think it's really important to start in the place that your work is like that brings you joy, because when you're coming from that place, whether it's public or private, I feel like it's you're doing it for the right reason.
Victoria, TJ, Bryce, thank you so much for being here. Fascinating conversation. That's TJ Jarrett, Victoria Banks, and Bryce McLeod. Check out our liner notes for this episode, like the full version of Victoria's song Firefly, the transcript of TJ's poem, and photos of Bryce's creations.
Get in on the ground floor, kids.
That's on our website, wpln.org/movers. And while you're there, you can also sign up to get on our ultra-fun mailing list. Many thanks to Carl Peterson, Cameron Adkins, Mac Linebaugh, Anita Bug, and Kim Green. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions and by Dave Coleman and Justin Shipper. I'm Emily Siner, and this is Nashville Public Radio.